It's time for Sounding Off with Phil Goff.
Mate, who'd be a councillor on your council when you're cutting back on business class travel?
It's a bit tough, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, it's part of the responsibility we have to manage ratepayer and residents' funds appropriately. And I think, you know, look, there are reasonable exceptions for that. If you've got a long distance flight and you've got to hit the ground running when you arrive at your destination.
Yeah, we've had this conversation before, Phil, yeah. And you're sticking up for business class, but now you've decided to...
No, to the contrary, there's a total consistency there. We've always had a policy, and we said if it's a short run flight, which we define as less than 8 hours, it's economy. If it's longer run, it's premium economy. If there are special circumstances, such as I've just outlined to you, then you can apply to the chief executive for an exemption to travel business class. And that balances, I think, responsibility and common sense.
Tightening the purse strings, or we've run out of money?
We're always short of money. There's always much more to do than you've got money to do it with. But I think it's about trust and confidence in council. People want to believe that we are spending money, their money, as if it was our own money, and therefore taking, you know, the necessary restraints and prudential approach to how you spend it. People, you know, when you pay your rates, you say, look, I understand why I'm paying my rates. It pays for roads and it pays for parks and for water supplies and all of the other things that council does. But we want to know that you are handling that prudently and with constraint. So it's about sending that message that that's exactly what we're committed to.
Now, the costs that sort of come along with being in council can change from year to year, can't they? I mean, there was a lot of discussion in the last couple of years about consultancy costs. Will we be applying the same Scroogeastic?
I'm accused of being a Scrooge, but or a Grinch, I prefer to think it as just a prudent way of dealing with the money. Now, you know, in regard to consultancies, we've got to make a decision in each and every case. Is this a function that we can do in-house? And if it's a function that we are carrying out all the time, yeah, it always makes sense to do it in-house. If it's a function where we don't have the necessary expertise and it's a one-off, then you're going to have to bring in somebody from outside to do it. And that does cost more, but it costs more if you're maintaining its staff with a level of expertise that you only use, you know, once every so often. So it's finding out what provides best value for money. And again, that's a common sense approach to it.
Do you look at the consultancy though with a careful eye though, and sort of hone in on what should be taken on sort of as a full-time thing and what should remain a consultancy issue? I mean, is that constantly being reviewed and checked out?
That's a responsibility of the Chief Executive Office, Stephen Town. We are the governors on the governing body, as the name suggests, so we exercise oversight, but we don't do the day-to-day management. If we got into the day-to-day management of contracts, that would prove a bit difficult. But there is one employee that we have in the council that that we control whether that person is retained in that job or not retained, and that is the Chief Executive. So the line of responsibility is from the chief executive to the governing body, and the chief executive has the responsibility to run an executive leadership team that carries out all of those particular functions you're talking about.
Right on. Now tell us about the Kauri dieback situation. No one can go. You're shutting it down. We're shutting down the Waitax.
Well, we're closing down the forested areas with some exceptions, and those exceptions will depend on whether there is any risk. If there is no risk, because the path is a first-class path and it's not involving trekking by the roots of kauri trees and it's not involved trekking through mud, then that will be open. So there'll be a number of paths still open, but they will be the exception to the rule that by and large the forested area of the ranges will be closed. Now, obviously, we do that with some reluctance. You know, all of us love to get out there and walk the tracks. But when you look at the figures that we had for the last 5 years, the number of trees in the Waitakere Ranges infected with dieback disease, which is fatal and for which there is no cure, it doubled from 9 to 18% of all of the trees in the park. And we know that if we don't take pretty radical steps, then we're going to see the loss of that tree, at the very least the decimation of the trees, and potentially even the extinction of the trees in the Auckland region. And I don't think that's a risk that any of us want to take. And, you know, even if we close everything, as we're doing now, with exceptions for safe tracks, there is still a risk of the spread of disease. So we're pushing government to up the level of research on how we find an antidote to that. We've found something that can delay the extension of a tree's life that's infected, but we haven't found a cure yet, and we need to keep
working on that. Does it make it harder when the trees themselves are so live for such a long time?
Yeah, because, you know, look, if it's an ordinary everyday tree that has a lifespan of, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years, if you lose a tree, well, you planted another and you can catch up pretty quickly. But when you've got trees that are as many as, you know, 500 or 600 years old, when you've lost them, you're never going to see specimens like that again in our lifetime or our kids' lifetimes or our grandkids' lifetimes. So it is the king of the forest. It is an iconic tree, and we've got to protect it. Now, what worried me before, we took, you know, the council officers had taken pretty important steps. They'd closed off 44 paths, etc. But what worried me was the impression was being given that it's still optional. If you can walk down that track if you want to.
But yeah, you guys, I mean, there was the Rahui, there was a stern warning. Surely that should have been enough to keep everybody...
No, I don't think the Rahui is enough, because probably 80% of the population don't understand a Rahui and don't necessarily accept that it's scientifically based. So we have to have alongside the Rahui, which is...
Are you disappointed? Are you disappointed in Aucklanders for not towing the line there?
Well, I got to say, some of the comments from our Kauri dieback ambassadors were pretty awful. People said, to hell, we're going down to the falls, whether or not we run the risk of spreading the disease. Now, that's irresponsible. Often it's simply ignorance. I was listening to interviews with people at West Auckland yesterday. They didn't understand. What we've got to do, we've got a couple of responsibilities. One, make it absolutely clear what the level of risk is and why we've taken this action. We've got to be credible in what we do. But then we've got to take practical steps. So it's a case of not just saying track closed. It's a case of a big, you know, the notice in the Herald yesterday, for example, it was the Rahui notice. It wasn't put up by council. It was put up by one of the tree groups. It said, there is a Rahui. This is a customary prohibition, and please don't use the track. That made it, first of all, people didn't understand what a customary prohibition was. And secondly, when it says, please don't, it implies that actually that you've got the alternative of using it if you want. And we've got to say, this is not a request. This is a clear prohibition, and it's based on science, it's based on evidence, it's based on the fact that the main form of spreading that disease is people walking in, getting mud on their boots, and then transmitting that disease from tree to tree, and at the worst scenario, transmitting it from area to area. So we've closed some areas of the Hunuas that are not yet infected, and we've closed them because they're not yet infected. The high-risk tracks, we've got to do everything in our power to preserve this tree. That's our obligation to forthcoming generations, and I take that seriously.
Most people are awesome, and we'll take that all on board. Some people are dicks, though, Phil, and aren't going to pay attention to that. So how do you police it? Because it's a massive area to police, and I guess hard to anticipate when it's going to be busy and when it's not.
Yeah, 16,000 hectares. unless you put minefields around it and concertina barbed wire, you don't have an absolute certainty. But what we've got to do is indicate that when people have given due warning and they've chosen to ignore it, that we are prepared to take it to an enforcement level. So we will be able to take action under a trespass order. The government, because we're asking the government to put a controlled area notice there, which talks about not taking mud in or out of the area, the government will have a responsibility to prosecute under that notice. And we will probably need to go to government and talk about not simply relying on prosecution, but whether we can impose infringement fines. At the moment, we can't. Prosecutions are bloody expensive and time-consuming. Infringement notices would be far better, and we'll be looking at talking to government about whether we can issue infringement. We have the statutory power to issue infringement notices if people choose to ignore the warnings that are given to them.
So a couple of text messages have come in saying that ask the mayor why healthy kauri trees have been chopped down at the back of Tirarangi Village when we have the situation of the dieback. Another one saying, why Waterkia want to cut down healthy kauri and we just found red gecko in the area. Do you know anything about those two situations?
If it's Waterkia, and they're talking about the new water treatment station that's required in Tirarangi, there is a process that Waterkia have to go through before they cut any tree down, and I have an assurance from the Chief Executive of Waterkia that they will do everything possible to avoid cutting down any significant tree. Now, you know, do we need a water treatment station? Of course we need it. We've been through a process of looking at alternative sites and extensive consultation. I understand that if you're going to build a big water treatment station and there's a tree on the place and you can't avoid it, then the tree would have to go, but we're trying to minimise the damage to it. In regard to the trees at the back of the Tirarangi shops, I've got no idea. They may be on private land, and the previous government did reduce the level of tree protection that we've got, and the new government, I hope, will look at restoring some balance in that so that we provide greater protection to existing trees. The final thing, and I've got to say this because I had a tree group turn up at council yesterday and show me a picture of Wormsley Park and a picture of an exotic tree trunk where the tree had been cut down, saying this is disgraceful, this is an abomination. And I said, actually, see all that earthworks that are happening there, that is because we are daylighting the Oakley Creek, so we're restoring its natural path as an urban river instead of a drain, and we're planting 50,000 native trees there.
Boom in your face.
And if we have to cut down some weeping willow trees, which, you know, aren't iconic trees, and we have to cut down the occasional exotic tree to transform that area, you know, that's what you have to do sometimes.
The willow is definitely a creek clutter-upperer.
Yeah, it creates all sorts of problems. I don't want to be disrespectful of the group because they're well-intentioned people and they work hard to preserve trees. But I do want sometimes to, you know, a little bit of acknowledgement the other way. We planted 100, under the Million Trees Program, we planted 170,000 native trees last year. This year we'll probably be doing between 250,000 and 250,000 trees. We are making a huge effort to improve the canopy cover in Auckland, to have more carbon sinks to meet our obligations under the Paris Agreement, to protect riverbanks against erosion and coastal areas against erosion. We're working with the Corrections Department, we're working with iwi, we're working with Rotary, we're working with Trees for Survival. Every tree counts, and I think we're doing a pretty damn good job there. What we had to do in the Waitakaris, it breaks your heart because I'm a person that loves walking down bush tracks. But if we have to do that, unlike the myrtle rust, which carries by the wind, and I don't think we'll be able to stop myrtle rust, with kauri dieback, because it's carried on the predominantly by human beings on their boots through mud, yes, we can reduce the chances of spread by possibly up to about 80-90%, but I also need Aucklanders' support to do that, and that's why I've put into the 10-year plan and our consultation document that comes out at the end of this month that we are looking for a targeted rate to protect our environmental heritage, and that will be first and foremost directed at stopping kauri dieback. So instead of spending $3 million over 10 years on protecting against kauri dieback, council needs to spend $100 million. But, you know, if people say we don't want to invest in that and we don't care if the Kauri die, and they make that clear to councillors and councillors vote against it on that basis, that would be a tragedy. I think we have to do something, and that's why I'm looking for public support, so that we not only pass a resolution, but we back it up with resourcing. Because if you don't put the resourcing in, your statement of principle might be pretty empty.
Now, finally, Phil, the funky weather we've been having lately has meant that the berms around the town are absolutely ludicrous. Who's in charge of those?
Well, yeah. Hey, let me say up front, I went down to the Batch last
week. You're going to lose two or three walking school buses in some of those berms.
Yeah. Let me give you an explanation. I went down to my Batch last weekend to cut the lawns. They were up around my knees. I'd cut them about 3 weeks earlier. The grass growth in the last couple of weeks has been phenomenal. I cut my lawns at home the other day, and 4 days later they needed cutting again. So I don't want to make excuses for the contractors who I think haven't done across the board the job they should have done.
Oh, no. The weather's just been extreme.
But give them a break in terms of the weather. From time to time, they will be longer. But that should not be a lasting thing. We've got a spell of, 4 or 5 days of dry weather, touch wood, and hopefully they can start to catch up on the backlog of that. But, I do accept that when it's pouring down in rain and the grass growth is phenomenal, the thing will look untidier than it should do under normal circumstances.
All right, Phil, thanks for talking to us again. We'll speak to you again this time next week.
Thanks, Mikey. Cheers, mate. Bye.
That was Sounding Off with Phil Goff.